coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Education issues are likely to be high on the agenda at Legislative Hall this year. And House Education Committee Chair Earl Jakes is working through how to prioritize them.
Well, I'm going to get some of them done, but I don't know which ones. I got to talk to my colleagues, see what support I can get, talk to all the stakeholders, find out how we can get it done. Some of these are easier than others.
We sit down with State Representative Jakes to look at what legislation may be coming to address education in the first state. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also meet two more candidates in the race for mayor in Newark. Our latest arts playlist tells us about a UD musical ensemble headed to Carnegie Hall and how some students are helping make sure they look the part. And we take a trip down memory lane in this week's Enlighten Me to learn more about the history of first state movie theaters. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Education issues are likely to garner a fair amount of attention from state lawmakers this year, and one of the people shaping the legislature's education agenda is State Representative Earl Jakes. The House Education Committee Chair is passionate about ed policy and has a long list of priorities, including some more controversial proposals revolving around how to address low-performing schools and the referendum process for school funding. The Glasgow area Democrat recently sat down with Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller to outline what he'd like to accomplish.
So what are your top education priorities?
So my number one priority is we have to teach children how to read. I'm a member of the Southern Regional Education Board. At that meeting, the last one I was there, I was sitting next to a representative from Arkansas. And Arkansas was just about like us. They were, over the years, they had been like in the 40s for academic performance. And all of a sudden, I noticed the last couple of years, they're moving up. They're in the 20s now. So I said to the representative, what do you attribute that you're moving up so much in your academics? And they said they started having their higher education institutes teach the science of reading. It's the way that you teach children how to read. You know what I mean? And so they went to higher institute, they got that done, and then they went to their teachers that are already in the classroom, and they teach them science of reading, and they give them a stipend for doing that. The little special identifier goes on their license, and they get paid for that. And they said that is the biggest difference, and that's why they're moving forward.
Your first priority is reading.
Reading, absolutely. Reading's got to be number one priority.
What about the governor's reading coaches in his budget?
Yeah, he's putting some reading coaches in there, but kids need to read everywhere, you know what I mean? You know, when we have daycares, the way we have daycares, right? You know, we have really good daycares, we have some okay daycares, and then we have Aunt Susie, the lady next door, and all that teaching. So that's part of a problem because they don't know all the things they're supposed to know. First Lady has an initiative to register all children for kindergarten that maybe we should be including in there like a little survey to find out if the children can do certain things. Where are they at in those levels, right? I always tell this story. I went to my daughter. My daughter's a 20-plus year kindergarten teacher, right? So right after school started, I happened to go to her house, and on her kitchen table, she had these shoes. Not pairs of shoes, just shoes. And I said, what's this? And she said, did you notice they're all tie shoes? Oh, I said, oh, yeah, they are. And she said, that's because I have to teach children how to tie their shoes. And I have to take time away from the classroom to teach them. And she said, the sorry part of it is the kids who know how to tie their shoes, I have to give them busy work while I'm teaching these kids over here how to tie their shoes. That's just one example of how kindergarten teachers have to do things, you know what I mean? If the child comes and they're not prepared, if they don't know their ABCs, they don't know their colors, all those things that are required when you come into kindergarten, you got to know. So we have to figure out how we're going to do that, you know what I mean? That's the thing. My second priority is actually wellness centers and mental health. We got to figure out how we're going to take cover of mental health in the schools because we're not going to hire 326 mental health professionals, one for every school. We're just not. So then we have to figure out a system of how we are going to do mental health because We need all grades. K through 12, we need all grades to be able to have access to get mental health, right? So we have to train somebody, you know, the school nurse, probably the best qualified right now, to identify mental health issues that are going. Then we can turn them over to the real mental health professional. You know what I mean? So we need to figure out how we're going to do that. You know what I mean? So that's Colonial has a really unique program right now. They're having a family wellness centers. The whole family can come. Now, you know, all that stuff is paid for by their own insurance or the Affordable Care Act, whatever they have. You know what I mean? So it doesn't cost the state anything. It's not a state cost. Number three on their courses kind of goes along with the governor's proposal, more money for ELL, low-income children with disabilities. Yeah. So we need to make sure we're funding them properly, the right resources. Number four is allowing school districts to raise operational money without a referendum. You know, we're only one of four states in the entire country that doesn't be able to have that ability. So right now, if a school district needs operational money, they have to come for a referendum, right? They're difficult to pass referendums. Very seldom do they pass on the first go. They can, but they very seldom. And it's very costly money-wise and manpower-wise to get a referendum passed. Right? Well, you know, there'll be parameters how much you can ask for over a certain amount of period of time because they just can't raise it constantly, you know what I mean? We have to have parameters on it. But you know, if the people don't like what the school board does, they vote them out. Just like me, right here today. I could raise your income tax today, right? A legislator can raise their taxes. What's your recourse? Your recourse is vote us out next election, right? That's your recourse.
And I think the byproduct of that will be that we will get more interest in people running for school boards.
And your next priority is?
We have to figure out a way to be able to intervene in low-performing schools and how we can help them, you know, get up to where they need to be. So we have to figure out how we're going to do that. Because there's low-performing schools out there. We know they are, right? The governor's trying to work with ones in Wilmington right now. But we have them all over the state. They're not the only place, you know, when you look at it. So we got to figure out how we as a state are going to be able to do that. One of the things I'm working on personally is voluntary school assessment. Some people call it impact fee. When a developer builds a building, builds a development, right? If they're not capacity in that school district that he's building in, he has to pay an impact fee so that they can build schools and stuff like that to take care of these children that he's bringing in, right? That's how that works. So it's called the voluntary school assessment. Each county has a different arrangement, but Newcastle County's is messed up. And so we're going to try to straighten that out a little bit. This is a fee that a developer pays, not a taxpayer pays, a developer pays. So if I'm a developer, whoever you want to say, Ryan Homes or Anderson Homes, I don't know all the developers, but anyway, yeah, if I'm building a development, right, say I'm going to build it in Apo School District, I'll just pick them out, right? Okay, and they don't have room for those children that I'm going to be building houses for. I have to pay an impact fee so that they can build a school for it. Yeah, that's how that works. It's called an impact fee. Well, it's actually called voluntary school assessment by the law. Well, there's nothing voluntary about it, by the way, but it's called voluntary school assessment. So we're trying to straighten it out. We've been meeting with developer and all that stuff. We're working on it. We've had some meetings with different superintendents and all that. We're working through it. We're trying to get the stakeholders to get squared away so we can do a new law that will deal with voluntary school assessment in Newcastle County first.
Just in Newcastle County?
Just in Newcastle County first.
How much can you raise, do you think?
Oh, the fees are all different fees, so you have to figure out what it is. There's different fees. That's part of the problem, the fees are kind of on.
Would that be instead of using bond bill money?
Well, you use some of the bond bill money, but you got to have some of your... It costs a lot of money to build a school, you know. What, Dover High School was 120 something million? It's a lot of money, right? They wanted to build a new Hudson Vocational School right across the street from me. The estimate was 185 million. It's a lot of money. The Velvers impact fee isn't going to pay for all that. So there's got to get money from different ways, right? Substitute teachers pay. Hadn't been raised in over 10 years. We got to get that done because it's ridiculous what we're doing. Last one I have, well, I have two more. But the last one, really, not the last one, really, is a data center. You know, we have a data center. It's up on DuPont Highway in Newcastle area. It's paid for by Colonial and Red Clay right now, those people. They do all their data for them. But we need to really have the whole state under that same system. So we collect all the data. You know, last year, I and Senator Scola did a transparency bill. That's all part of it, is like we got to have the data all look the same so we can all figure it out, that a parent should be able to figure it out, a district can figure it out, everybody can figure it out. Legislature can figure out that data. But right now you can't because it's all over the place. Because each school district has their own way they do it. They have their own format. They have their own software. So we need to centralize that. So I've got to figure out how to do that.
Is that going to cost the state money?
Well, right now, the people who work there, they're in the state retirement system. They have state health care, but they're not technically state employees. They're not paid by the state. They're paid by the school districts. So we got to figure out how we can make that work. We'll figure it out. We can do it.
Are all of these priorities going to be pieces of legislation?
Some will be. Some's going to take me a while to get it done.
Will all of these be done this year?
No, won't all be this year.
What do you think will get done this year?
I'm going to get some of them done, but I don't know which ones. I got to talk to my colleagues, see what support I can get, talk to all the stakeholders and in different ones. I got to talk to them all, find out how we can get it done. Some of these are easier than others. I'm pretty sure a voluntary school assessment is going to be done this year. I can guarantee you that one because that one's almost done now. It's pretty well close. But some other, reading's going to be done because the governor wants it, DOE wants it, I want it. So we'll get it done. We're going to be funding ELL and low income. The governor has a proposal out there. So it'll be working. It'll be going. In what form is another question, but it'll be done some sort. Some of these others will be a little harder to do, you know what I mean? Operational money without a referendum is going to take me a little longer. That's controversial because the public will be not as positive as I was hoping they'd be. But we'll have to work on them a little bit.
Thanks to State Representative Earl Jakes and our Sarah Mueller for their time on The Green this week. And stay with us. We introduce you to two more candidates in the race for mayor of Newark. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. Listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The deadline to file as a candidate for mayor of Newark was Monday, and now there are five candidates running for that office. Previously on The Green, we highlighted one of the candidates, 21-year-old UD student Kasai Guthrie. This week, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with two more, Catherine Saferni and Jerry Clifton.
The race for mayor of Newark is wide open after current mayor Polly Searer announced last month she would not run for a third term. Among the five candidates is political newcomer Catherine Saferni. I recently met her in a cafe on Main Street to talk about why she's running.
I'm running for mayor because in the 10 years that I've been attending city council, I feel like the communities have become very segregated, and I'd like to see more smart growth and cohesion within the community and university environments.
Saferni has not run for office before.
I think I bring a fresh perspective with a lot of diverse knowledge in terms of many different populations.
She describes herself as an engaged citizen and advocate. She says she participated in a community economic development program at the University of Delaware.
It was 8 hours a day for entire Saturday and Sunday for 15 weeks, I think it was. And I've also done the certification that the city used to offer for citizens. I was in the first group that Councilman Temko did. I've been attending council for 10 years. I've been an advocate, community advocate, advocate for citizen rights, and advocate for citizens' rights, housing rights, and transportation for a long time. I communicate with legislators on a regular basis. I'm not uncomfortable with, you know, looking at best practices in other places and asking questions about them and why don't we do things.
Seferni came to Delaware 15 years ago as a member of the AmeriCorps. She now works with international students at the University of Delaware's English Language Institute.
Newark's economy locally, when it has grown in the direction of being an international economy. The international student population has expanded, and I think that we can revitalize some of our festivals by adding some of that international flavor and reaching out to our international community. I don't know that enough of that has been done. We had the New Newark Night that got canceled. This year, they used to have Battle of the Chefs. It's last year because of low attendance, and I think those events are great, but I think they need to evolve so they don't become stale, and I think those are some things that can be done on the ready, on the quick.
She thinks Newark's influx of international residents through the university offers an opportunity.
I do see the growth in that potential. I do know nationally that's where education is trying to reach out to because of the prediction of shrinking domestic market. And I think it's a great way, if we can make international students really comfortable, where they feel welcome, then they will be comfortable settling here.
Seferni says she wants to improve the relationship between the city of Newark and UD.
Making the university and the city a much more symbiotic relationship. I've been to some presentations, and it feels that both sides, there's a lot of tension, and you feel that both sides feel they're parasitic on each other rather than symbiotic.
She thinks more communication and engagement on both sides would help.
Always people talk about student behavior and student issues, and I think that you can do that at council, but to really do that, you have to have students present at the table as well. And so I think that there needs to be a lot more workshopping and forums in conjunction with the university and mediation.
Seferni says she would also focus on smart growth and planning in Newark, especially around the university.
I've been an advocate for a more diversified Main Street in terms of age and ability, physical ability. We have a lot of elderly people toward East Main Street who have wheelchairs and things. And as Newark has been developing, I feel a lot of those needs are left out of the planning.
She says she doesn't think the current city council is looking far enough into the future.
I think Newark ultimately really needs to be prepared for what education is going to look like since it's in the next 10 to 15 years, because that's what we're building for. And national economists predict something different than what we're building for. We've become a mono portfolio in terms of we are largely only education and student housing are our two main industries right now, whereas we've lost a lot of other industries, and we've lost the Chrysler plant, we've lost Avon, and if the education bubble does burst, as some are predicting, Newark's going to be in a lot of trouble. And so really looking to the future with broader vision, I think, is what's needed.
Also among the candidates for mayor of Newark is longtime city council member Jerry Clifton.
I've served on city council for 19 years, and 9 of those years I served as deputy mayor.
Clifton filed to run for mayor after Sear announced she would not seek re-election.
I would not have run against her, and with her stepping down, that certainly opened the potential of running.
Clifton is a retired Delaware National Guardsman. He thinks his experience sets him apart from his opponents.
This isn't a time for on-the-job training. This is a time that for someone who has real-life experience sitting at the dais, working with staff, working with employees, and not having to learn as you go. And I think that I'm the one candidate that really does bring that forward.
He also points to his philosophy on Newark's government.
I have a great relationship with the other council members. I think that I bring a different way of governing, meaning that I look at council myself as being a facilitator, but all of us being co-equal in the process. I look at governance as far as council is concerned as being a team sport, and the team isn't just the seven of us at the dais. It's the management employees of the city, and most importantly of any of them, the residents of the city of Newark.
He holds some of the same goals as Saferni.
You know, we need to continue to really improve our relationships with the University of Delaware. We need to send clear messages that are unified messages. If it's something that we want from the university and so forth, and I think likewise they need to send some clear messages to us. But I think that we need to work to a more collaborative environment there as well. There's a lot that the university could do for us that I think they've fell short in some instances, and we need to see where we agree, we need to see where we disagree, and move to a common goal. And I think their goal of having their students in a good, clean, safe city is the same goals that we have for our residents and for the part-time residents, the students. We need to drive to those same end games, and people need to sit in the same room and they need to talk. And all of us, myself and all the other players, need to check their egos at the door and sit down and have a serious conversation of what we need to do.
He's also concerned about optimizing city improvements.
We have the reconstruction of Main Street, and we need to continue to work with DelDOT to lessen the impact on particularly our business community.
But he thinks the most urgent issue facing the city is administrative.
Well, certainly the elephant in the room at this point is selecting the next city manager. That is a really, really important step forward for us. We need to continue to drive forward to the goal line on that, to put somebody in place that's permanent, because there is a trickle-down effect as far as the other positions that are left vacant, that have been open because of, I think there's a little trepidation in filling certain positions because not being permanent, but we still nonetheless need to move forward.
Catherine Saferni and Jerry Clifton will face three other candidates in the Newark mayoral election on April 9th. Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks to Newark mayoral candidates Catherine Saferni and Jerry Clifton, and our Sophia Schmidt for their time this week. You can also find Delaware Public Media's interview with 21-year-old candidate Kasai Guthrie on DelawarePublic.org. Next up is our latest arts playlist, which highlights a UD musical ensemble prepping to play Carnegie Hall with the help of some UD fashion and apparel students. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The University of Delaware's Master Players Concert Series Ensemble in Residence, Six Wire, takes the stage in New York City later this month. And when it plays its sold-out show at Carnegie Hall, the ensemble will be wearing some very special performance attire. The attire is being designed and made by a team of UD Fashion and Apparel Studies students. The concert, Six Wire and Friends, is being produced and presented under the direction of Master Players Concert Series Artistic Director, Shang Gao. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Gao spoke with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about the concert and what they'll be wearing.
We've got some great news. University of Delaware fashion students are going to be designing the attire for an upcoming concert at Carnegie Hall. Tell me all about that.
Yes, on the 16th of February, which is a Saturday evening, 7:30, University of Delaware Master Players Concert Series will produce a historic concert on the stage of Zanko of Carnegie Hall. And we are producing new music and featuring world-class guest artists of Master Players as well as UD faculty and students to really promote Delaware artists, Delaware art, and Delaware music. And then as part of this whole presentation, we invited the Department of Fashion Design under the direction of Professor Belinda Orzada to lead a group of graduate students and undergrad students to design the concert attire for the UD Ensemble in Residence Six Wire. So Six Wire is a world-traveling crossover ensemble, if you will, representing the University of Delaware and performing in U.S., Europe, China. And in this concert, the three of us, Matthew Brower, piano, Kathy Yang, who's an Erhu Chinese two-string violin virtuoso, and myself on the violin, will be performing new music. And then we'll be wearing God knows what they're designing, but hopefully something that's really appealing, and I'm really excited.
This is exciting, though, for the students, right?
I think so. I mean, we're giving the stage of Carnegie to them to showcase, their vision, and I think the audience will be able to really experience the expression from the students artistically for a long 2 hours show. They will be to see the outfit. I think they're designing two sets of attires, so first half and second half. I'm really excited for the opportunity. And also the students who are performing in the UD Symphony Orchestra and UD Chorale under the direction of our faculty conductors, Paul Head and James Anderson, they will also be featured and honored. And so it's a great celebration for all excellence happening in the state of Delaware and at the University of Delaware.
Shang, how close to the performance do you expect to see the costumes?
That's a great question. I really want to try them before the final sound check, because we have to move on stage. I want to make sure these outfits fit very well. I think maybe the week of. It's exciting. If I were a student today, undergrad student designing fashion, I would be really excited for this opportunity right in downtown New York City. So I have strong confidence this is going to be gorgeous and also comfy and practical and everything. So,
and probably very colorful as well, right?
I don't know. It's all up to them. I think so. We talked about a lot of things, cultural encounters of the two instruments. The arhu is an ancient instrument originated in ancient Persia, and so did the Western four-string violin. So the reason we call ourselves Six Wire is because the 2+4, combining the cultures of East and West and bringing new sound, new music, new repertoire to the world of classical music. And then they capture that. And then we talked a lot about visually what we do on stage, the instruments, the colors of the instrument, and even the repertoire. And so it's a true interdisciplinary education that we're providing to the Delaware students.
What is the title, if you will, of the performance?
The title of the performance is called Six Wire and Friends. If you go to Carnegie Hall, well, actually, it's already sold out, so that's a good problem. But but you could people could be, you know, put on a waiting list. We do have some cancellations usually, and then but if you want to learn more about the concert, it's listed on our website, masterplayers.udel.edu. Masterplayers, one word, .udel.edu, U-D-E-L.edu. So that's the concert produced by the flagship presenter on the campus of North Delaware. We're bringing world-class ensemble soloists to perform in Delaware, and then as part of the service and education provided, these artists come work with local communities and teach the students and going to schools. Recently, we even started a new series called Master Players at Christiana Care. So we're bringing world-class musicians ensembles to the Christiana Hospital, a joint venture with the hospital. And also we have a little master's project catering free instruments and lessons to the underprivileged kids in Wilmington. All over Delaware. So it's a really a message we're sending to the people of New York and the world, that Delaware is not behind any other state or presenter. We're actually doing world-class events everywhere. And this concert, you know, was sold out 5 weeks ago. So really exciting.
And this collaboration with the students, I mean, it's got to be a great learning experience for them.
Yes. Absolutely. You know, I think it's thinking outside of the box these days. You know, I was rehearsing with Six Wire the other day. We decided, oh my God, what are we going to wear? This is such a cool concert, all the new music, and we should take some photos. Then I remembered, gosh, we have a fashion design program that's very, very much a pioneering program here. Now let's contact them. And they love the idea, the administrators of the department, and then they jumped right in, and the students got excited. So, it's just really, I think, creative thinking and collaborative work, and that's what humans do. You know, when we brainstorm, great things happen.
Will they be designing your outfit for the evening?
Exactly. So all three of us, the pianist, arhu player, and myself, we'll all be wearing something beautiful, colorful, exciting, and funky and fashionable, hopefully.
You sound a little hesitant there, but no, I'm just giving you a hard time.
I'm really excited. You know, it's visual art and music, they both give people so much pleasure.
Thanks to UD Master Players Concert Series Artistic Director Shang Gao and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. And the Green concludes in just a moment with Enlighten Me and a look back at movie theaters throughout the years in the first state. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The 2019 Academy Awards will be handed out later this month. The Oscars are an annual reminder of just how big a part movies play in our nation's cultural life. But the way we experience movies today is far different than it used to be, a fact driven home by a new book entitled Historic Movie Theaters of Delaware. Its author, Michael Nazarevich, digs deep into the history of the places we've watched films in the first state and chronicles the changes they've gone through over the years. Nazarevich spent 20 months researching and writing this book, and in this week's Enlighten Me, he joins us to discuss it. Let's start at the beginning, which is what you do in your book. You start by identifying the first movie theater in the first state, and I guess it could come as a surprise to people exactly where it was. What did you conclude?
What I wanted to do, Tom, was not just determine the first movie shown in the state, but since films were introduced to theaters that already existed, I wanted to go back and find the oldest theater I could in the state. Researched historical text and came to the determination that what's now known today as the Everett Theater in Middletown began as the Middletown Opera House in 1868. There may have been other buildings that were built prior to 1868. A good example is the Queen in Wilmington. But the Queen was built as a hotel, not as a theater, and then later became a movie house, whereas the Middletown Opera House was built as an opera house along with the town hall, and it eventually went on to show movies.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people would have maybe made the assumption that Wilmington would be the place where you would find that first theater, but it turns out it's Middletown.
I was surprised as well. Like many, as you say, I was expecting something in Wilmington too, considering it ultimately became really kind of the most densely populated part of the state to have theaters.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, theaters grew pretty rapidly here and around the country, particularly obviously in the early part of the 20th century. And the one thing I was kind of struck by just kind of going through this book was just how many they were for a small state over the years. Were you surprised at just kind of the number of movie theaters that Delaware housed at one time or another?
I really was. That was one of the big surprises for me. I must confess, my initial idea was to focus on New Castle County and maybe some just sort of some bias coming out there. But thinking with Wilmington and how densely populated it is, that there would be the majority of theaters there. But as I continued to research, I was really surprised at how many theaters were all over the state, and really pleasantly surprised that there were so many small towns that had their own theaters, that had their own hubs of entertainment and centers where the community could gather, that I never would have guessed 150 when I started my research, but was very pleased to land at that number.
And it's funny, what you just mentioned was another thing that jumped out at me, and probably something that younger people are not aware of in this era of the multiplex. Just how significant a part of the community movie theaters were for so many years. They were really significant places in towns, weren't they?
They were. They were so often the main sort of gathering point for towns, for political rallies, for community meetings. Oftentimes, school commencement exercises were held in these places when they weren't being used for entertainment purposes. So the community went really and repurposed these theaters as they needed to. That still goes on today. Here and there, there are still theaters that are used for community purposes, but nothing like it was back 100 years ago, 150 years ago.
As you look back in your research, was there a, you know, for lack of a better term, heyday or a golden age for movie theaters in Delaware?
So there was. So, you know, it sort of peaked in 1921, where based on my research, there were about 59 theaters that were open around the state at that time. When you consider that today there are about 20 theaters open at this point in time, or 22 rather, that have shown films in the past or presently show films today. So that was sort of the peak number. So you're dealing with a lot of opera houses and movie theaters happening at the same time, and you're still dealing with vaudeville entertainment. So there was this great sort of transition where all of these types of entertainment were happening around the same time. So you have all of these places to put all of these things on. And then, of course, when you move into the 30s and the 40s, you sort of get into the golden era of Hollywood. And you sort of see these larger movie palaces start to open around the state to sort of reflect the entertainment of the time.
And I also found it really interesting, you know, going through this book, that it was interesting how societal issues like indecency, race relations, played out with movie theaters. And in a lot of ways, the movie theaters and how they dealt with those issues kind of reflected the times and the debates of their eras, didn't they?
They did. And topics like those were a big reason why I chose the structure of the book that I did, rather than just have a collection of, like a list of movie theaters and to give each theater's history as its own entry. I really wanted to show the evolution of theaters and the evolution of theater going over this 150-year period. So, you know, like you say, decency, there were the blue laws in the early half of the century, and then when you get into sort of the adult entertainment licenses in the 70s and 80s and all of the drama that sort of surrounded that, plus segregation and integration and so forth. When you think about what we just talked about how theaters were sort of the central point of the community, and then when you look at these larger societal issues, once you kind of go through that entire 150 years, it all sort of fits together, that oftentimes theaters reflect what's happening in the community and in society at the time.
I also found interesting, you had a lot of really cool anecdotes in this book, like some of the big movie names that at one time or another kind of came to Delaware for one reason or another. Can you share a couple of the anecdotes that you thought were kind of like really interesting when, you know, Hollywood, for lack of a better term, came to Delaware?
One of the stories that I found early that really sort of drove me to look deeper into this was the Clint Eastwood story. So in 1977, Clint Eastwood wanted to have his film The Gauntlet screened in advance of its major release to see how an audience would react to it. The Branmar Cinema in North Wilmington was chosen for this experiment. I could never find a formal reason, but one of the theories that was posited in the papers then was that Delaware was close to Eastwood's home, which at the time was in Connecticut, and he didn't want to go to a city like New York where he would be easily identified. So I have to assume that Philadelphia was scratched off the list for that reason as well. So he winds up in North Wilmington at the Branmar. He's there in disguise, and he's going to sit through a screening of his film with your average Delaware audience. But because the advertising of the event wasn't handled quite as well as it could have been, very few people showed up. So Eastwood left, and his co-star and I believe his partner at the time, Sandra Locke, she stayed and watched the film with the handful of people that were there to see it. So I thought that was a really, really great story about a theater that I went to when I was a kid and had never really had heard about or knew about. It was reported in the paper and kind of came and went, that I thought would be a great story to tell today, considering what Eastwood went on to become and has become today, this, you know, this superstar and this director and this sort of Hollywood icon. And here he was in Delaware in 1977 trying to show a sneak preview of his film.
And the fact that it didn't work out is that, I guess, the thing that makes it even funnier is that it just kind of, as a plan, it flopped.
Yes, absolutely. And what's so great is I recently spoke to someone whose father worked that night at that theater and sort of confirmed that. So not that I doubted it, because it was seemed properly reported. But as the book starts to make its way on social media and people start to learn about it, I'm starting to hear stories like this. So to hear that Clint Eastwood connection of someone who was there that night was really, really neat.
Fascinating. And you also know that Delaware was one of the first places to screen Star Wars. Tell us a little bit about that.
Another great anecdote, and one that's very personal to me, as I saw Star Wars at the Tri-State Mall Theater in Claymont in 1977. I don't know that I was there opening weekend, but I do remember standing in a very long line to get tickets in the pre-Fandango era, when you had to get there and wait in line for tickets. Star Wars today is this cultural, multi-generational phenomenon, and sort of everyone knows about it in one degree or another. In 1977, while it was certainly exciting and had a lot of buzz about it, it was still sort of this singular thing. It was film. There were toys and T-shirts and that sort of stuff that came with it, but nothing like it is today. So having discovered that Star Wars was the Tri-State Mall Theater was one of 45 theaters to screen Star Wars when it originally opened, was really, really neat that a Delaware theater was sort of on the ground floor of that. Tri-State was the only theater in Delaware to screen it for a full month, which when you think about how films are screened today and how every theater seems to have four or five theaters with the same film running at the same time, it's interesting to see that a film of that consequence was being shown in one theater in the state for a full month before other theaters had their crack at it.
Which kind of brings me to my next question, which is, like, things are so much different now, and, you know, particularly in this, you know, this era of multiplexes. How much do you feel like we've lost in this transition from the community theater, the small theater, to, you know, these mega theaters, as you said, that are oftentimes running the same movie on multiple screens throughout the day?
When you look at a place like Market Street in Wilmington in its heyday, and you've got maybe an 8-block length of Market Street that's got 8, 9, 10 theaters on it at the same time, and you look at a multiplex today, which has 12, 14 screens, we'll say, you know, 17, let's say, in People's Plaza, just to point to the biggest one in the state. There's an advantage to having a lot of choices in the same place, as well as a lot of choices with a very big parking lot where it's going to be easy to get to and to sort of that centralized. But you do lose variety. And some of that variety is lost because these theaters need to stay in business, and this is the model. And if running a Marvel film on half of their screens will help keep them in business, that's okay. And I say that as a fan of Marvel films, but you lose that variety that these 7 or 8 theaters or 10 theaters along Market Street would have 7, 8, 10 different movies, and you do sort of lose that a bit.
You also note, though, at the end of this of the book, that there are some of these older theaters that are coming back in one form or another. How encouraging is that some of this history is being, in one way or another, preserved?
It is. It's very encouraging. I was really encouraged to see that the Ball Theater in Millsboro is going to make a comeback. So this was a theater with a great history. It was owned by a former baseball player by the name of Huck Betts. He was a pitcher. He played in Philly. And when he retired, he opened this theater. And it eventually closed in the 70s. And a couple of folks in Millsboro are looking to reopen it as a live theater as well as show movies based on reports. So that's encouraging that a small town like Millsboro will have its own theater, that there won't be a lot of drive time for folks. You know, as I've driven around the state and I've spoken to people downstate, one of the great challenges that folks downstate have is a lack of choice. For some, it's Rehoboth or it's the Clayton and Dagsboro or it's Dover, which covers a pretty big stretch of drive.
Yeah.
So the more that these smaller towns can get more theaters, even if it's just to see a movie once a week, it's better for the community.
And looking back through your research, is there a favorite theater or two that you have, or maybe one or two that have the best story?
Wow. So I would say that for me, it's probably the Warner Theater is high, high, high on that list, because it really, you know, it opened in 39. It ran until the mid-70s. It was sort of the crown jewel of all the Warner-owned theaters in the city. So when Hollywood came to Wilmington in that era, it typically came through the Warner. So it had a lot of that old Hollywood glamour to it. Its manager, Lewis Black, was an amazing, not only manager, but a community leader as well. And I do get into a bit of his biography in the back of the book, where in the back I try to call out specific people or families or organizations that I think played a significant part in the history of movie theaters. And I do speak about Lou Black specifically. So I really like the Warner as one of those sort of most historically significant theaters. I would put the Everett on there as well, because it does date back to the first one, and it survived two fires and a couple of financial-related closures and a ceiling collapse, and it was in Dead Poets Society. So there's a lot of great history at the Everett as well. So those would probably be my top two.
Thanks to Michael Nazarevich, author of Historic Movie Theaters of Delaware, for enlightening us this week. The book is slated for release February 18th. You can pre-order it now at Amazon.com. And when it's out, it will be available at Barnes & Noble and other smaller bookstores locally. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Muir, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.